I want to talk about Isaiah chapters 46 and 47, because in these chapters, Isaiah is really making fun of the gods of Babylon. He is mocking Babylon, and it is describing in very caustic terms the destruction of Babylon. He says, Isaiah 46:1, Bel bows down, Nebo stoops, their idols are on the animals and on the livestock. The things that you carried about are a heavy burden. It seems to be a vision of the gods of Babylon being removed from the city on wagons pulled by oxen as the Persians advanced. And they have to be carried. And he's sort of making fun of that. Verse 2, they stoop, they bow down together. They can't deliver the burden, but themselves have to be carried away. Then chapter 47, verse 1, come down and sit in the dust, virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground without a throne, daughter of the Chaldeans. You shall no more be called tender and delicate. The idea is that you're going to be mocked, abused, and raped. Take the millstones and grind meal. You're now you who were once the pretty girl are now the slave girl who must grind at the mill. Remove your veil. Strip off the train. Uncover your legs. Your nakedness is going to be uncovered. Yes, your shame will be seen. And I will take vengeance upon you. And in fact, so much of later Isaiah is mocking the Babylonian gods, and particularly the cult of Marduk. Now, this is radical stuff, because the prophecies of later Isaiah were specifically for the Jews living in Babylon and Persia, as later it became. It was specifically to encourage them not to be caught up in the culture where they lived, but to return to Judah and to be strong in their relationship with Yahweh, the God of Israel, and to believe that the city they were living in and the empire they were living in was going to fall. But the book of Esther, I think, reveals how far they had got caught up in idolatry. I mean, Mordecai is the hero, but his name is a form of Marduk. And Esther herself, I mean, her name means a star. This, again, is another form of reference to Marduk, the star god. And Ezekiel repeatedly laments the idolatry of the captives. I know that later they did become very sort of hyper-religiously aware, but initially they were worshipping idols in captivity. And this kind of material, like you've got here in Isaiah, which is mocking those gods, mocking those idols, and is really talking about the destruction of the very empire which had really treated the exiles quite well. I mean, they didn't stay long sitting by the rivers of Babylon, weeping as they remembered Zion. They got on pretty well in Babylon and in Persia. They ended up in positions of power and authority. And that's, to me, the sad ending, really, of the book of Esther, that the Jews are in power, in authority, they're popular, they're wealthy. You know, this is why Haman says, if I get permission to kill all the Jews, I'll pay a huge amount of money into the king's treasury. Yeah, because they were wealthy. That's what he was thinking. And so they were very caught up in the ways of Babylon and Persia. And so to speak of Babylon in this hostile way was a very brave and unpopular thing to do. And I think that probably this book of Isaiah as a document would have been sort of hushed up, that, that's not what you're supposed to read. Better not let the Babylonians know that we've got that scroll here, because it's cussing them, it's laughing at their gods and saying they're going to be destroyed. It's rather like the book of Revelation. That book is all the way through mocking the cult of Caesar, the cult of empire worship. And, you know, especially the way it begins with Jesus presented as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and he's called that again towards the end of the book of Revelation. Well, that's the very phrase that was used about Caesar, that was on the on the coins, on the temples, on the statues, etc. There was a cult of Caesar worship. And the Book of Revelation would have been illegal. It would have been subversive literature. So my point is that we too are living in our exile, as it were. We're living in this world. Because the language of the Restoration and the call out of Babylon is applied to us. Come out from among them and be ye separate. 2 Corinthians 6, this is exactly the call to the exiles to be separate from Babylon. So we are called to a radical counterculture. And it really is a radical counterculture. If you live by the Sermon on the Mount, this is a radically countercultural statement. If you forgive, you don't take people to court to recover debts or whatever. If you forgive without repentance, if you trust not in human justice and seeing justice done, as people like to say these days, but you trust rather in God's justice, you do not fight your enemies, you are committed to a life that is non-materialistic, that is based around kindness, gentleness, generosity to all people, doing good to others, considering their feelings. This is a radical counterculture to the totally egoistic, me, egocentric culture in which we live in, where to get wealthy and to be thought well of is the peak and the pinnacle of human achievement. And we are called to something else. We're called to live not for this world. Our kingdom is not of this world, but for the kingdom that is to come. And our allegiance is to Jesus, and not to any worldly leaders or principles. Now, to live like that is a radical thing. And there is a radical in every one of us. Even if the years might have somewhat blunted it, there is a radical in every one of us, because it is natural to want to kick against the system. Now, young people do that by dyeing their hair pink and doing stuff they know their parents would disapprove of and that sort of thing. And you know, then they calm down and become adults and so on. And a lot of people are, if you like, spiritually adolescent. They like to do a few things that are shocking or believe a few things that are out there in left field, not popular, etc. And as I say, that this is part of being human, to want to kick against the ties that bind, to kick against the society around you. But that is just immature behaviour. We have been given, in true Christianity, in the Christianity of the Sermon on the Mount, the absolutely most radical counter-cultural way to be and live. The teachings of Jesus are not just, you know, a culturally acceptable thing to have in our lives, and people think you're a top bloke if you go along with them. There is something radical about them. I mean, he asks us to crucify ourselves, to take up our cross every day and follow him, to sacrifice all that we might hold dear, be it family, be it the pursuit of wealth, the pursuit of apparent stability in life, for his cause, to go into all the world and preach the gospel. And so many things, to, as I say, to radically forgive without demanding repentance from people, to see whatever we've got in life, whatever good cards we were given, as talents we've been given, to use in his service, not for our own self-advancement. And this is a radical way to be. And as I say, there is a radical in every one of us. But express your radicalism in his way.